The sun has powered life on Earth for billions of years. It may yet power our civilization, too. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. As humanity grows and advances, now a decade and a half into the 21st century, we're learning to appreciate the limits to the resources that Earth can supply. As the global community works to lift billions out of poverty while facing the challenges of energy supply and the realities of a sensitive climate system, new possibilities beckon both within the Earth system and beyond. While some researchers work to reproduce the near-limitless potential of the sun's fusion power here on Earth, others are working to harness that solar energy directly from the cloudless, perpetual sunshine of outer space. Both technologies have long appeared distant and challenging for technical and economic reasons, but new innovations may make space-based solar power surprisingly practical. John Mankins is a former chief technologist for human exploration and development of space at NASA, and is today involved in a number of enterprises and organizations pursuing space development. He heads the startup company Mankins Space Technology, focused on development of space-based solar power systems. Western World's John Kissy spoke to Mr. Mankins about the prospects for supplying Earth's energy needs from space and the developments that are bringing that vision closer to reality.
Can you tell me a little bit about your company and what the goal of the company is?
So I worked for 25 years for NASA in advanced concepts and new technology development and management. And over the years, I've been involved in a number of advanced space systems ideas. And one of these is space solar power, which I've been working on for about the last 20 years with colleagues from countries around the world. A new concept that I've developed and studied for NASA in the last few years is that of solar power satellites by means of arbitrarily large phased array, which is represented by an acronym SPS Alpha. And this is a new way to do very large space systems out of many small parts. And I'm currently pursuing that through my company, Mankins Space Technology. And I'm working with a non-governmental organization here in Canada by the name of Space Canada, the director of which is George Dietrich, to promote an international dialogue on the topic of space solar power.
It's a very interesting subject, especially with the current economic climate and the questions around power generation. There are many different ideas for generation of large amounts of clean energy. Can you tell me exactly what it is about this idea that has caused you to create a company that has made you pursue this idea as opposed to any others?
So space solar power as a concept is about 45 years old. It was invented by a gentleman by the name of Peter Glaser back in the 1960s. And it's really elegant and quite simple. On Earth, you have to deal with the day-night cycle. You have to deal with changes in the seasons. You have to deal with weather. And as a consequence, in most places around the world, on average, you only get a few hours of bright sunlight per day. Well, if you go to space near Earth, you can get sunlight of more than 99.9% of the time. And so if you could effectively, safely, and economically harvest sunlight in space near Earth and send it to locations on the ground, you could make solar energy renewable, sustainable, available for the next few hundred million years, available to all of humanity. And that's a very appealing idea. Unfortunately, past concepts for how this might be done were wildly expensive. They were based on systems technologies and architectural concepts from the 1950s, 1960s. They looked like great big mainframe computers the size of Manhattan. And as a consequence, the budget estimates for what it would cost to build such systems were in the hundreds of billions to trillions of dollars. And so they never went anywhere. However, in the past decade, new system architectures have emerged that have been made possible by the advances in electronics, wireless technology, robotics, sensors that allow us to envision platforms that would comprise literally hundreds of thousands of small robotic elements. And they would self-assemble in space. And so these would deliver power to the Earth essentially from islands in the sky. So platforms like a coral reef, where you have multiple robotic species interacting, harvesting the sunlight, processing it, sending it to Earth, and do it with costs to get started of tens of millions of dollars, not hundreds of billions of dollars. And that's what's really changed the situation and made it, I think, a near-term prospect.
So that's very interesting. You're talking about creating semi-autonomous constellations of robots that do some sort of energy conservation from the sun and then linking that together. And okay, so can you explain, you highlighted some of the technologies that have come together to make this cost effective. Can you go into a little bit more detail about some of the technologies that have actually made this possible?
So the central difference between SPS Alpha as a concept and a constellation is that in a constellation, all of the small satellites are separate. In the SPS Alpha, they're all assembled together. So in the same way that a large number of ants might assemble to make a bridge or to build a ladder, and then the other ants can use it, in the same way the piece parts that would make up an SPS Alpha platform physically assemble into a larger structure. What makes that possible are really three critical innovations. One is the idea of distributing energy to all of the different pieces of the satellite using mirrors rather than power cabling. If you've ever looked at the power cabling behind a modular component stereo unit, you see wires and cables and power lines going every which way. It's a nightmare. Well, similarly, in space with large space systems like the International Space Station, you have a lot of power cabling. And it's very expensive, it's very complicated, it's subject to failure, and this is a big problem when you get to big platforms. So distributing the energy as sunlight, i.e. with reflectors, with mirrors, gets rid of all of that. Secondly, in cooling a big spacecraft, or cooling any kind of large, high-power electronic system, there's a lot of waste heat to deal with. And as long as spacecraft are basically like city buses. So it's a big box and all the electronics are inside. You've somehow got to get all of that heat out. Now, on Earth, we use fans. You circulate air, it cools the electronics, the circuit boards. There's no problem. Well, it can overheat, but there's less problem. Big server farms, you hear about them cooling it with water and refrigeration and all of that. Well, in space, you don't have any water. You don't have any air to circulate. And as a consequence, you have a tremendous problem with waste heat and keeping the electronics cool so they don't fry themselves. So the second key innovation is to make the spacecraft essentially planar, i.e. it's flat. The pieces of the spacecraft are flat, so the surface to volume ratio is far higher than it is with any conventional spacecraft. So every single piece of the SPS Alpha ecosystem cools itself by radiating its waste heat off into space. And third, of course, a big lightweight structure like this is going to be floppy. It's going to be flexible. And so if you're going to use it effectively to send energy to Earth, you have to have some way to correct for the fluctuations in the shape of the platform, the shape of the transmitting antenna. And that's to be done using a technology called the retrodirective phased array, where a pilot signal, a reference signal, is sent from the ground to the platform. All of the onboard segments receive it, and they can measure their relative distance and frequency from the location of where the pilot signal is being sent. To give you an example that you might be familiar with, think about a symphony orchestra. So 100 different musicians, all talented, all know what they're doing. Listen to the cacophony, the noise, before they begin to play, and it's just a mess. When the conductor steps up and he lifts his baton and he taps it, suddenly everything is in harmony. Everyone synchronizes to the beat and to the music as the conductor directs the 100 members of the orchestra. Similarly, using the reference signal to provide both phase and frequency from a single point on the ground, all of these pieces of the platform, regardless of some minor differentiation in position or angle, they all know where they are relative to the pilot signal. And that's enough to allow energy to be sent.
What about receiving technologies on Earth? What are you sending back to Earth? And then how do you turn that into electricity or power?
So what we would send to Earth is a low-intensity microwave beam with a wavelength of about 12 centimeters. So that's about 5 inches. And the technology to handle such electromagnetic waves was first developed 70 years ago to develop radar before and during World War II. And so those technologies are quite old and mature. To use them in wireless power transmission is only something that came along in the 1960s. There's a great genius by the name of Bill Brown, who worked for the Raytheon Corporation, now some years dead, who helped develop a technology called the rectifying antenna. It's just a simple dipole antenna, and you connect across the base of the two parts of the antenna a Schottky diode. And as the electromagnetic wave comes in, it oscillates the electrons in the antenna, and the Schottky diode basically rectifies half of them. And so you end up getting out a direct current, a DC voltage, just as you get from a PV cell, a PV array. And so the microwave energy at low intensity, about one-tenth of sunlight, would come down, would interact with a field of literally millions of these rectifying antennas. The energy would be converted into electricity and then go from there into the marketplace. Now, one of the great triumphs of Bill Brown and the early research was to develop what are these rectennas, as they're called, so effectively that they're already at, that they've been for years at conversion efficiencies of something like 91%. So once the electron, there's a lot of technology to be done, component technology to be done on the space side. But once the microwave energy reaches the Earth, it can be converted into useful electricity with an efficiency of more than 90%.
Wow, okay. And the system in space, how effective can that be at collecting sunlight?
So another really wonderful technology advance of the last 20 years are what are called multi-band gap PV cells. So cells which are designed to strip out and convert particular portions of the solar spectrum, different wavelengths of the incoming light. And using these multi-band gap cells, there are actually cells now available commercially, although the price is still high because not very many are being manufactured, that can convert sunlight into electricity with efficiencies above 30%. And the expectation from a number of research laboratories, including those of the U.S. Air Force, is that these conversion efficiencies can be improved to more than 50%. Now, on the electronic side, the best solid-state power amplifier that you can buy today has a conversion efficiency of about 70%. And then there's some losses in the other ancillary electronics. So today, the best that you could do in going from sunlight to the microwave energy going out would be, say, about 30% times 70%, or about 20%. Now, we believe that as this technology progresses and as these systems are developed, that further improvements will take us to PV, photovoltaic conversion efficiencies of about 50%, and the power electronics of about 80%. And in that case, we'll get to be, the net will be about 40%. And so at the end of the day, if it's 40% end-to-end in space, 90% on the ground, then it's remarkable. It's remarkable. And the nice thing about it is, of course, the thing that really makes it attractive is the strategic value of having solar power 24/7. You don't care about the weather. You don't care about it being nighttime. And this is power that in space can see, in principle, a whole continent or two continents. So a single platform in space, geosynchronous Earth orbit over the Indian Ocean could, in principle, deliver power to a market anywhere from Hyderabad to Cape Town, from Berlin to Moscow. It sees multiple continents and could, not all at the same time, have to choose which one, but it would be able to deliver power across a third of humanity from one platform.
So then perhaps the next question is, what kind of time frame are you looking from start to finish in terms of launching to get it up?
If everything was to go when we started today, we'd work through a series of increasing scale demonstrations. So we wouldn't, because the whole point of building large systems out of small pieces is you can start small.
Yeah.
So we'd start with prototypes, we'd start building demonstrations, we'd take those to space, we'd put together more and more elements and learn more about how to improve the interfaces, the individual devices inside the modules. For the full scale system, the masses are quite large. Even though it's made out of small pieces, something like 10,000 tons. Now, how many launches that would take kind of depends on the launchers. And just to give you a sense of perspective, today something like 20 launches take place a year, 20, 25 launches, on that order, to of significance. For reference, in the 1980s, before spacecraft lived so long, the world launched about 90 times a year. So in the past, within the space age, there were on the order of 90 launches per year. If you go back to World War II again, and it's a terrible reference, but it's just a historical fact, the V-2 rocket, which was launched from Nazi Germany to attack Great Britain, launched something like 4,000 rockets in an 18-month period. So the idea of having lots of launches is by far more than we have today is by no means magic. It's been done. It could be done. To give you a sense of scale of the logistics problem, a single solar power satellite we envision would probably be deployed over a year, which would be a lot of launches. But for reference, the mass and the logistical challenge is the same as is handled by Federal Express from its field in Tennessee every day. So it's one day worth of Federal Express's shipments from one airfield in the U.S. in one day. So it's a lot for space. It's a lot for us to imagine. But for the modern economy and for the terrestrial industrial scale for air freight, it's a modest amount to do that over a year.
Okay, so any young students who are listening to this or young people who are thinking of taking up engineering, for instance, what kind of skills would be really handy to get into this kind of area?
So when this architectural approach to space takes hold and the idea of making big systems in space out of lots of small networked intelligent pieces takes off, then space suddenly becomes a real industry. And there's the opportunity for hundreds of thousands of people to be employed worldwide in making these things. And the kinds of skills that would be required would include, obviously, the traditional aerospace engineering, obviously for the all the electronics and for the antennas and the power transmission or advanced communications, electrical engineering, Obviously, there are enormous opportunities in robotics, in computer science, in advanced materials. I mean, it's the full gambit of advanced engineering and physical sciences degrees, and not the things that bleed or breed or breathe. So not living things, but on all of the machine side, it's almost everything.
Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about your background now. How did you start on your current path?
So I first went to undergraduate at the Harvey Mudd College. My degree was in physics with a double major in literature. I got my master's in physics from UCLA, I was a double major as a graduate student at the Drucker School. Got my MBA in public policy analysis, and I was all but dissertation in American constitutional history, except I got offered a position at NASA headquarters and went for what was supposed to be a one-year assignment and then didn't come back. So I worked for about 10 years while I was doing my graduate degrees at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and then for about 15 years at NASA headquarters. In a variety of jobs involving advanced technology, program management, and the advanced concept studies. Probably one of the jobs that I enjoyed the most was being the chief technologist for the Office of Human Spaceflight and being the manager of the Exploration Systems Research and Technology Program that was going to develop the innovative technologies to accomplish the vision for space exploration. That was announced in 2004. Of course, things went in a different policy direction after that, and I left NASA and have subsequently been involved in technology consulting and creating and killing several new ventures, including the latest one, which will try to pursue the modular approach to space. I've also been involved in a number of nonprofit organizations, including the International Academy of Astronautics and Space Canada, which has been sponsoring the exhibit here at the International Astronautical Congress in 2014.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much.
Okay.
You're listening to Western Worlds. Let's go to the discussion.
So, we just listened to my interview with John Mankin, talking about solar power from space. Very interesting. Some really good ideas. Obviously, he started his own company, so there are obviously ideas in some way as well. So, I mean, what do you guys think about that?
I love the idea of solar power. I just think all this time we have not been using that and using oil and other kind of resources. Like, really? Sun is there. It's free. Like, you know, we should have had technology by now to harvest solar energy into whatever we want, like, you know, running cars to having electricity. And I mean, I know, like, having it here on Earth is kind of hard, as you talked about, like, you know, you don't get enough sunlight to harvest for all the time, but, like, really, why didn't someone think about putting things in space? You know,
I mean, I think the there are certain limitations on the technology. I mean, he did talk about how those structures put together in space, how they'd have to be self-assembling. This is something that, while it can be fairly low tech, with the whole kind of formation flying in space that would be required, the coordination between different parts, that's kind of more of a newer type of thing. But yes, I mean, it's a fantastic idea, I think, and the fact that it's solar power 24 hours a day is a really interesting concept. Putting it up in orbit really takes away a lot of the drawbacks of solar power as it is at the moment.
The whole concept is well thought out and very well explained. I like the way the concept was. Small modular parts start small, but it has the potential of growing and providing a large amount of energy. the justification was very good, was well laid out. As you say, he's very clear in the way he does it. There's lots of questions I have. I wonder quite a lot about the energy, total energy budget. And they're hoping in the long term, by the time you've captured the energy, transformed it into microwaves, sent it, captured it, that maybe they can go up to 40% or something like that, right? This is the ideal target. Well, your first justification was that wherever you are on Earth, you're not going to get 24 hours, but you are. There's some places that can get 10.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you can get to 40% if you choose your spot right on Earth.
And I mean, you know, you could always think about other sustainable ways of getting, you know, energy. Not just solar power, but, I mean, having solar power in the daytime, kind of have you something which is renewable or sustainable at the nighttime, if need be. Or think about ways to store the energy collected over the daytime for the resources at nighttime, or when the sun is not around, you know, days when you have snowstorm, like when we have here. Not seeing sun for days is kind of normal here, and so trying to, you know, have solar energy 100% at 100% rate all the time is obviously going to be hard, but if we find ways, research ways to, you know, store it or use it as from space, you know, to actually give everyone on Earth a chance to kind of grab energy, because it's very expensive in, you know, countries which are not developed to have electricity. I mean, I'm from India, and like there are a lot of villages in India that don't have electricity still, and so it's normal for them to like not have, you know, resources that they could do at night or things that they could use to, you know, survive like others do. So having such harvesting power using solar energy might also be, you know, able to give light to everywhere, like, you know,
exactly.
Giving power for everyone.
And that's got to be really got to be one of the biggest potentials of this idea. I mean, you could set it up in such a way that you don't have to store it.
Yeah.
That it's all power
yeah.
as it is. Because
yeah.
the satellite never has to be out of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, energy storage, of course, is very important and rapidly progressing technology as well.
To set something like this up, there's a really big energy overhead and materials. You need to invest a lot of energy products, plastics, in order to get something like this set up. You're not going to use solar power to put these objects in space.
Only up until you get to a certain point.
Right.
You don't have to keep using other types of energy once you get to the point where you're harvesting enough energy from this. You can use the energy from this to keep putting stuff up there. You know, you can use the energy from the sunlight to split certain chemicals so you can store them in other hydrocarbons, synthetic hydrocarbons, and burn that in a self-contained cycle. Like, you can do this. The problem is the initial energy spend. The initial energy spend would be high and require using a lot of the types of energies that apparently we don't really use anymore, that it wouldn't be a good idea to use anymore. But whenever you're talking about a renewable source of energy like this, it's the same with solar power. So solar panels are great, they're renewable, but what are they made out of? So all those special elements that they're made out of, how are you getting those elements? Oh, you're burning fossil fuels to dig them out of the ground. That's how you get them. So even when you create something like a solar panel, which is renewable energy, that energy that goes into making that has to come from somewhere. So the idea is to choose a technology that, when it is operational, will give you the most renewable energy so that you can decouple yourselves from the old style of energy that you're using. And this is one of those types of energy. It has a lot of benefits. the fact that it's always, it can be always producing power, the fact that it can be set up to service more than one place simultaneously. It doesn't have to be a huge monolithic structure. It can be a structure made up of lots of smaller structures, meaning it can be reconfigurable. A lot of potential as an idea. And if you, I mean, if you can beam the energy down from space, it, you know, can revolutionize, revolutionize energy generation. At least as part of the future energy makeup of our civilization.
I wonder if the microwave energy transmission technology couldn't be used to transfer energy more efficiently on Earth.
Yes, it could be used to potentially transmit energy more efficiently on Earth, that's sure. One of the interesting functions would be the energy loss over the air. I don't know the details of that. I don't know how far that's come along. But I think that even as it is in the moment, it's quite efficient. It's quite an efficient process. So that's quite interesting.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and featured an interview by co-host John Kissy. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Parshati Patel, Tony Martinez, and John Kissy. Our editors were John Kissy and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWCPSX, and on Facebook, we're at facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can find world enough and time to join us again right here on Western Worlds.